Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget? Quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I know I say that every week, but I do genuinely mean it. Also, sorry if that Hey Griefsters was a bit jolly. It's hard to know where to pitch it sometimes. If you've been enjoying the show, please do rate and review us on iTunes, and don't forget to subscribe. I know everyone asks you to do that because it helps other people find the podcast. So thank you if you've already done that, genuinely. Thank you very much. We have a Griefcast live. Coming up on June the 6th, we'll be at the South Bank Underbelly Festival. Underbelly South Bank Festival. I think tickets are available now. I haven't sorted out my guests yet, but trust me, they're going to be three very exciting comedians talking about death. So if you want to come to a live episode, make sure that you buy tickets. That's how you will come to see the live episode. This week I'm talking to Paul Mayhew Archer. You might not know that name, but you've definitely watched some of the comedy shows he's involved in. He's been a writer and a producer, commissioning editor. He famously co-wrote The Vicar of Dibley. He worked on My Hero and Miranda. He also produced thousands of radio programmes from Weekending, Time Sorry and Haven't a Clue. If you've liked a comedy show, he's probably in some way been involved. He's also started doing stand-up very recently, since he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and he has a show that he's touring at the moment called Incurable Optimist. It's on at the Soho Theatre this week, but then it's also touring all over the UK, so definitely check that out. You will enjoy this chat with him very, very much, I guarantee it, and do go and see his show as well. Paul came in to talk to me about his mum, who died when he was in his early 20s. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with writer, producer, performer, commissioning editor, and legend, I would say, of comedy, Paul Mayhew Archer. Hello.
Hello.
You've worked on so many shows that it's almost pointless to list them all.
Yes, don't bother.
Yeah, because there's just so many. But you're probably best known for Vicar of Dibley.
Yes.
So you created Vicar of Dibley.
No, I didn't create the Vicar of Dibley. I co-wrote the Vicar of Dibley.
Co-wrote it,
yes.
Yeah.
I was working at Channel 4 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And helping to commission shows there, like Drop the Dead Donkey and Father Ted.
Oh, I love Drop the
Glorious
Dead Donkey.
Father Ted and yeah. The Glorious Drop the Dead Donkey. And I got a call from Tiger Television, who were working with Richard Curtis, and they said he's working on a new sitcom called The Village about a woman vicar. And he's looking for someone to write with. Would you go along and have a chat? So I thought they were... He wanted to pick my brains about writers to work with.
Oh, right, yeah,
so
yeah.
I took a list of 10 writers and I said to him, I said, they're all lovely and I think you'd have a lovely time and they're very good. And he looked a bit bewildered and said, oh, I see, I thought you might like to have a go.
You nearly talked yourself out of a job.
Yes, absolutely. It was pathetically useless of me. He said he'd seen a sitcom, a short-lived sitcom of mine called An Actor's Life for Me, and he'd rather liked it, which shows you don't need sort of millions of viewers. You just need one.
Yeah,
if he
the right
to be
one.
Called Richard Curtis.
And it helps if Richard Curtis.
That's right.
Stuff.
And he, so I, even then I didn't sort of push myself. I said, well, oh gosh, because he'd done Blackadder and Mr. Bean by that time.
Wow, yeah.
So I was a bit in awe and I said, well, I'll send you some storylines and if you like one of them, I'll write it up. And luckily he did.
That's very lucky. You almost talked yourself out of it twice.
Twice? Pathetic.
No, I can understand. It's Richard Cut. I mean, yeah, he's... Anyway, Blackadder was just... It's
well,
still
it
one of my absolute...
Sublime.
Sublime, yeah. It's almost perfect, isn't
and,
it?
And then we sort of worked on it. We did the first series, and I did some of the episodes in the first series. And then, of course, we were going to do it. We were doing an Easter special, and I rang him up to talk about it. And he said, can I ring you back in half an hour? It's just... I've got this little movie that's opening in America, and they're going to tell me how it's done at the box office. And so he rang me back half an hour later to say, my little movie's number one at the American Pub. And from the moment of Four Weddings and a Funeral, it sort of, you know, just went stratospheric. So
so this was before Four Weddings?
This was just before
just
Four Weddings.
Wow.
And then whenever I rang up, you know...
It's quite busy.
I'd get Emma and she'd be saying, yes, it's just he's got Dustin Hoffman in the kitchen with him at the moment or he's just on the phone. And then with that and Comic Relief and Make Poverty History and everything. I saw his checklist of phone calls that he had to make one lunch hour while we were rehearsing, and it literally was ring Sting to confirm his appearance in the Comic Relief Dibley special. Gordon Brown rang, could you ring him back? This was Gordon Brown, Prime Minister.
Oh my God.
And the third one was Bill Clinton would really appreciate a call.
Oh, my God.
So, so I rang my wife just so I had someone to call, and she wasn't in.
But it's just as valid. Everyone
it's
needs to make those calls.
Absolutely valid.
We've all
yes,
got our own calls to make. Some of us Bill Clinton, some of us not. And that's fine.
Exactly.
I mean, amazing series, Vicar of Dibley. But it's funny because I know your name because I'm a radio comedy geek.
Ah.
And, yeah, and, like, for me... If you listen to a lot of radio comedy, I don't know if there's many of us, but you collect the names of people. And I'd always, like, if I liked something, it would say at the end, produced by Paul Mayhew. And I'd think, oh. And the first time, I thought, oh, I like him. And the first time I met your son, who's also a comedy producer, I was a bit awestruck because I was like, he must be Paul Mayhew's son. Like that. But I've never told Simon. Like, I was excited. I was like... God, he's like, oh, I'm Simon Mayhew Archer. Because he was working on a radio show I did with Adam Riches.
When
he was in radio. But of course, now he does This Country, the amazing This Country for BBC Three. But I knew him back when he was doing radio.
Yes, well, I'm actually a little bit in awe of my son.
Oh, that's
because
nice.
Because he does... wonderful things.
Yeah, This Country is amazing.
This Country, but Small Scenes, which you do with...
which I am in.
is a fantastic... I emailed him this morning just to say I love Small Scenes. In fact, what I love about the things he does is that they're all like nothing else around.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
And they're
yeah.
distinctive. And Small Scenes is wonderfully imaginative.
Who are we remembering today from?
I'm particularly remembering my mum.
Your mum. What was your mum's name?
My mum's name was Muriel.
Oh, Muriel, that's nice.
And she was about, I think she was 48 when she died.
Oh, wow. How old were you? And
I was 20.
That's young.
So that was 45 years ago.
Wow.
Now. 46 years ago, just
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
And I think it's the most profound influence on everything I've done, actually, strangely, looking at it. And it's only since I've started performing and what the show I do, Incurable Optimist, is about my Parkinson's and about my life before, but it's about the empowering strength of comedy and laughter. And that, as I discovered as I was working on the show, stems from the fact that I come from a household which didn't have very much laughter, because my... Not only did my mum... I mean, she died of cancer at 48, but basically, I think she had some form of cancer or other pretty well all my life.
Wow.
So she had breast cancer when I was very young, and she had a breast removed, and then she didn't really want to talk about cancer. She refused to go to the doctor if there was any, because she was so scared.
Oh, gosh.
And then she got cancer of the spine when I was 14 or 15. And now, I didn't know this, you see. The thing was, in those days, we were rather more patriarchal than we are now, thank God. And my dad was told by the oncologists that she had cancer of the spine, and she was given a year to live. And they said, we don't know whether you want to tell your wife. And he didn't.
Wow.
And he didn't tell me. Well, obviously, he wouldn't want me to know, really. And
oh my God.
We were living in a house where we didn't know if she knew she had it. In fact, she lived for 5 or 6 years till I was 20. And
That is an incredible situation.
Yes, and, like and said, I didn't. I mean, I didn't know. You see,
yeah.
I didn't know the what was going on. Really, I just knew I had a mother who was not very well and struggling with walking and things like that. And it wasn't until she got really bad, when I was about 19, that my dad told me. And so I was living in a life where living in a house where laughter was in short supply. And as I say in the show, you know, normally when people talk about doing comedy and they say, I wanted to make other people laugh. Mm. You know, I wanted to make my friends laugh so they didn't beat me up.
or the bullies
so they didn't beat me up. And I wanted to make, you know, my people who I liked laugh. And I think the truth is I wanted to make me laugh. and the best way to do it
was
to have a go at writing some comedy. Because I have always, luckily, sort of been able to make myself laugh and giggle. And the fact that I've been working all my life with other people whose mission in life is to make me giggle, first of all, as a producer or script editor. I mean, just phenomenal luck to fall into a profession like that. But I think it stemmed from the fact that I was living without laughter, or would have been.
Yeah. Were you, when your mum was sick and you didn't know, when you look back, do you think, oh, I did know, or was it just like was it just not discussed in those days?
No,
just...
we didn't discuss it at all. It was not, you know, herd of elephants in the room, enormous. I mean, it was very weird, because for a while she did sort of get better. She was convinced, or told us she was convinced, because I was an only child, that it was sciatica or something like that, or, you know, a trapped nerve in her back. And looking back, there's one day I managed to get tickets, because we lived in place called Bexhill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In Sussex, which is... I mean, I was destined to meet my wife, Julie, in Bexhill, because we were the only two people under 65 in the entire town.
I mean, it worked out.
It worked out very well. But the she was particularly keen to see a play at the Brighton Theatre Royal Brighton, because I think Ingrid Bergman was in it.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a good name for the Theatre Royal Brighton, yeah.
And so I managed to get tickets, but they were up in the balcony. I mean, they were in the highest thing. And I just remember taking her and my dad and to see this play and struggling up these stairs because she had her Zimmer frame and everything. And she was determined to get up there, and she did. And I look back on that thinking, oh, God, what pain did I put her through? And she was so uncomplaining about it. And she loved the play, and she was thrilled to see Ingrid Bergman and stuff. So in some ways it was a happy memory, and in other ways it was not. And I just think if I'd been, you know, had a bit more confidence and a bit more oomph, I'd have said, you know, I have a disabled mother. And yeah, I really appreciate it. Do you not have any seats?
Lower down.
But
I guess in a world where nobody's discussing ailments.
Nobody was discussing
these. You just, like, you know, you don't say anything.
No, and in fact, in the world of... Well, the very fact that you're doing this podcast with people who work in comedy is extraordinary, because when I started in comedy 40 years ago, you couldn't mention cancer.
Wow.
You literally couldn't. If you mentioned cancer, you were seen to be making fun of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it was exactly the opposite that you were trying to do. You're trying to address these things, and you're trying to address serious illness and death. And one way of addressing it is through comedy.
Yeah, because you soften it. What is a very serious thing. And I often, when people haven't heard the show, sometimes they're a bit like, you know, are you making light of people dying? I'm like, of course I'm not. No. And I always say, the fact that people die is not funny, but what happens around them dying is often hilarious.
It is absolutely hilarious. But, and there are always hilarious things. Yeah. And
always.
And you've got to treasure the hilarious bits.
Yes. Because there's so much rubbish.
There's so much rubbish. Yeah. And also, you know, the people who look after the people who are ill need that release of laughter. And also, with the person themselves, it's just possible that through the laughter and through the joking, you find a way of getting to a deeper conversation. Because so often you start with jokes and laughs, and then that enables you to sort of break down barriers. I sort of write things occasionally, particularly for Christmas concerts, for Maggie's, the cancer supporter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it seems to me that the atmosphere in the Maggie's centres is one which encourages laughter around. Every Maggie's centre has to have a kitchen table around which people can gather and and laugh.
Yeah.
And they seem to, you know, there's a desire of people, you know, whether it's cancer or, in my case, Parkinson's. I've been giving talks to groups of people with Parkinson's. There's a need and a desire for laughter. People want to laugh at their illness. You're not laughing at them.
No, no, and you're laughing
at the thing which
is the stuff that comes with that thing.
Yes.
And I think, you know, especially when people are ill, I mean, this is, you know, one of the reasons I do the show is when my dad was sick, it was, the air was so heavy with illness and cancer that any break in that was like coming up for air, you know? It was like, oh, there's oxygen. I remember what life used to be like. And that's what laughter gives you, this little, like, you know what, this isn't everything. This isn't how life will be forever. There'll be other times that you laugh. And I feel like laughter transports you into little, like, time travel. It's like, remember when you were happy? And you're like, oh, yeah, I will be happy again. This isn't everything.
Yes.
It's so important.
Well, in a way, the wonderful thing about laughter is that it's something you share.
Mm.
And it's something that brings us together. I think it's why comedy is so loathed. Or particular comedies are so loathed by people who do not get what's funny about something.
Yeah.
It's because...
because you're excluded, really, aren't
you? Excluded. It's all about belonging.
Yeah.
From our earliest sort of primitive roots as part of the tribe, we want to belong. And one way we can show we belong is by laughing at the same thing. But if you're surrounded by people who are laughing and you're not, my God, you hate... It's why nobody ever says that that's the worst documentary I've ever seen. But all the time they're saying, this is the worst comedy I've ever seen. Simply because, you know, you'd think you'd committed some crime, but actually all you've done is failed to give them a laugh. It's as though you've gone in and vomited over their children. They hate you so much. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
I know. I often say, you know, comedians often say this as well, like when you watch a drama, if there's a new BBC drama, you know, people will go, oh, yeah, I watched the first episode. Yeah, it's okay.
Yes.
Like, they're like, oh, maybe the story didn't go. But if they watch a comedy, they go, oh, awful. I hated it. I hate her. I hate him. It's not funny. And I think with the drama, no one, they would almost say, oh, well, I'm not a drama expert.
And yes.
I don't watch that many dramas, or I didn't understand what it was really about. But comedy, everyone feels like they have a degree in it. Like,
yes.
Because they laugh.
Yes.
They feel like, well, I have a degree in this. I can definitely have an opinion on it. And I've had people like stop me. I'm in one episode of the new Alan Partridge. And
I saw it, the first episode. Yeah. Very good, yes.
Well, it's such a, for me, an honour to be part of what I think is, you know, just one of my favourite comedies.
Yes.
And, you know, people with no comedy credentials at all just stop me and go, oh, I watched it. I didn't like the rest of it. Like my mum's friend. I was like, oh. And, you know, this is somebody who, they don't work, they've never written a joke in their life, but they feel very confident, able to say, I don't think Alan Partridge is funny. And you're like, what? Why do you think your opinion on that matter?
I know.
It's strange, isn't it?
But of course, their opinion is their opinion, and they're perfectly allowed.
Absolutely.
And what we can't accept is that we all have different senses of humour.
Yeah,
we all have one, but it's just
it's
a different,
just different
thing. I mean, and people, even family, can be like that. I remember years and years ago telling my grandmother that I'd started working. I was starting to produce Weekending,
at
the time was, you know, a big thing for a producer to be given Weekending, the topical, you know, satirical show of the week. And my grandmother said, oh, right, well, let me know when you're doing something interesting and I'll listen out for anything.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much. Yeah, always there to put you in your place, aren't they? So your mum was, your mum died when you were 20. Were you there when she died?
I was not. So I was in my first year at Cambridge and it was at the end of January. So I'd sort of gone back for my second term. But I remember the, you know, Christmas vacation, very, very difficult. And I mean, she was sort of bedridden and I just remember the bed sores. And that was deeply painful. And I do remember that I remember one night thinking, I'd love to go. Well, I wouldn't love to go, but something in me wanted to go and put a pillow over her head because I just couldn't bear
watch the
this.
Pain.
Watch the pain.
Yeah,
it was so all encompassing and it was horrible. And so then I went back, you know, to university, and she died a couple of weeks later. And there was something funny around the time, you know, beforehand, because I remember I proposed to my wife. Basically, I asked her to marry me and she said yes. And then I said, well, you better, it was 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, well, you better go home now. And I don't want you to disturb mum or my grandparents or my dad in the house. So I pushed her out of the bedroom window. It was a bungalow.
Oh, I see. Done. Deal sealed.
Sealed.
Signed the contract. You better leave now.
You better leave now. But we did it because we wanted to be able to tell my mum.
Oh, so you got the chance to tell her.
So we got the chance to tell her. But it's I shut down emotionally. Well, it was very odd. I couldn't cry because I sort of decided not to be hurt by these things. And it was years and years later, I was working on a show that I'd written and I'd got very tired and there was some sort of little problem with the script which I couldn't quite solve, which was a little problem. But because of my state of mind and my physical exhaustion and the fact that we were recording it the following Monday, as it were, became a huge problem. Do you know how you magnify things?
Yes.
And so I went to see my producer rang me up. That's right. And I said, I'd
gone home the previous night to fix this problem. And I rang up and I said, I can't actually come into work because I'm shaking so much. I can't actually drive at the moment.
Wow.
And she said, what do you do to relax normally? And I said, well, normally what I do to relax is write, but I don't think that's quite the answer at the moment. So she said, go and see every film in Oxford. This lovely producer, Susie Belbin, who also produced one of the great masterpieces, One Foot in the Grave.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so she said, go and see every film in Oxford. So I said, well, I will do, but first I'll go and see the doctor. And I went to the doctor and he said, ah, right, yes, you've got depression. Have some Prozac. So it was the shortest.
Yeah, oh, that's easily diagnosed, isn't it?
And so I went on some Prozac. And, well, about a week later, I was going into rehearsal and I was driving into London along the motorway. And I remember thinking, I think this Prozac might be having a strange effect on me, because I was singing a song and I can remember the lyrics very, very clearly. They went, fucky, 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 wank, wank, fuck. And I remember thinking, this is quite weird. But most of my brain was thinking, I don't give a fucky, 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 wank, wank, fuck. And strangely,
it's just definitely not what I thought you were going to say.
No. And I, so I came off the Prozac quite quickly. The doctor said it does have a worryingly disinhibiting effect on some people. So I came off the Prozac and I went to see a counsellor instead. And she started talking to me about my upbringing, because I'd said to her, oh, it was fairly normal, you know, actually quite funny, because I'd remembered lots of funny things that happened to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said how I came from quite a funny family, really, because my father was married to my wife's mother, because he'd remarried.
Oh, right.
And he'd married Julie's mum. I am married to my stepsister.
I see, wow.
Simon is not only my son, but he's my nephew, because he's the son of my stepsister.
Oh, my God.
So I was talking about this mad family and she said, ah, so your father married your wife's mum. So where was your mum? And that got me started on my mum's death. Mm. And I realised, and she said, well, you never really went through adolescence, did you?
Mm.
And I said, ah, that's interesting. I suppose I didn't really, because somehow deep down I was aware throughout my teenage years, I was very conforming and very controlled, and always have been, really, because the last thing you can do when you've got someone ill in the house is to rock the boat even more.
Yeah.
Because there's enough, you know, water being shipped in, as it were, anyway. So I used to joke with my dad. I used to say, my God, I'm going to be hell when I go through puberty. Incidentally, I should say, with the song I sang, I did about a year later go, and I had to have a medical just to be, you know, when you're working on a production, sometimes you have to have a medical just to make sure you're all right for insurance purposes. And I met the BBC doctor and I said I'd had this very brief bout of depression. And he said, and I told him about the song, and he said, do you know, I sing a song very like that. And I sing it to the chimes of Big Ben. Fuck, 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 fuck. Wank, 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 wank. But he said, amazingly, I don't need Prozac to do it.
That's so incredible.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it?
That is incredible.
The people you meet who are in positions of authority.
Perhaps it's a thing in men in a certain age. Or and I just BBC, don't know about the BBC.
Know.
Yeah, we just don't know. It's that is incredible. But also how... I find it interesting that he just said, oh, have Prozac, which I think, I don't know now. I hope now someone would be like, well, before we just give you these drugs.
No, 4 days after I was put on the Prozac, there was a documentary about it.
Wow.
And it said, one of the things it said was that it did unlock writer's block.
Oh, wow.
You did begin to write much more. But what you wrote was complete bollocks.
Oh no, that's like writer's Schrodinger's cat. It's just like, well, it will solve it, but everything will be shit. It's like, oh no, not Schrodinger's. I'm sure that's the wrong example. But God, that's incredible. But also incredible that you sort of had a, inverted commas, bad reaction that you then end up in counselling, because if you'd had a fine reaction, you might have stayed on it. Like,
I suppose so, and then become addicted to it or whatever. I mean, I did. I was quite reluctant to take it anyway, and I hated the sense of being out of control, as it were, because I've always been very self-contained, which I think again comes from the upbringing.
I'm very bad at being out of control, and everyone I've spoken to who's lost a parent quite young, especially teenage years, I think it comes from that, because your control got taken away from you.
Yes.
At a very, a point where you were supposed to be sort of wrestling it back and being like, I'm going to be who I want.
Yes.
And the world went, no.
That's right.
So I think it then makes you quite, for me, definitely quite uptight, quite anxious and quite like, no, I'm going to be in control of things, because the world is obviously not a safe place. So let's lock down, guys. So I've always, and I know antidepressants work for some people absolutely amazingly. They do. That's obviously brilliantly wonderful, but I think the movement to not hand them out so easily, I think, is obviously a good thing, because they do have strong side effects.
They do, and I mean, I'm now on lots of pills,
for
Parkinson's, so I'm aware that and they do have effects on you. Luckily, I mean, I'm okay with them, and I haven't had a terrible side effects, because some of the Parkinson's drugs can have serious side effects. They can lead to gambling addiction.
Oh God! Oh yeah, behavior. I heard about that on the radio. Yeah.
Yes, and they can lead to hypersexuality.
Wow.
My wife asked if I could start on those straight away, and actually I did, and they are fantastic. I have to say, we've had a lovely time.
This is, I mean, great. You know, that's what I mean. Like, if it's something, if you're going through something awful, there should always be benefits. There should be the plus side. Yes, there has to be the plus side.
And because with my mum, there weren't any plus sides. Yeah. This is the thing. I am determined to find the plus sides all the time and keep laughing and keep talking about it, because it's actually, it's very important to do so. And there are plus sides. When I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I decided to tell people in a letter, all my friends and all my family who sort of didn't live nearby. And the only letter I send out each year is the one with the Christmas cards. So basically that's what I did, you know. the normal Christmas letter that go the round robin from
people. Hope you're
all
well,
you know,
we've had a lovely year.
These are the holiday snaps, and the first child is doing so well at university, and they're sickening, aren't they?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
So mine was, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's. So I thought, that'll brighten up their Christmas. And
it definitely won't you not throw it away, but like, oh, it's just some usual letter saying other things. Like, what?
That's right. And three people got back to us and said, you must come and stay next year. We'd love to see you. So we had lovely weekends in the Lake District, the West Country and France. And it was only when they each took Julie to one side during the weekend at some point and said, just how long exactly has Paul got now? That we realised that they didn't know
Parkinson's
was a killer. We're still going back to one couple every year, and they say it's amazing, hey? And I say, I'm just taking it a day at a time. You know? So there are pluses.
I'm crying. Oh, my God. Just don't break it. Why? Get a free holiday. That's hilarious. Also, I think that's also interesting that they didn't say it to you.
No.
You know? Like, didn't say. So you could be like, oh, that's not what. So, of course, if they're sort of whispering about it, what? Yeah.
Well, they would, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they don't want to broach the topic.
It's difficult.
I mean, I strangely find it easier to broach the topic with other people who have other serious illnesses. Because I sort of feel, I mean, and this is maybe wrong and insensitive, but I sort of feel I'm a bit in the club.
There is a club
of people with debilitating serious, you know. Mine is at the moment incurable, so I feel I'm allowed to say and do certain things that others
We talk about that all the time in the show, of like, this is this is the club. Once you've lost someone, once someone very close to you in your family and your unit has died, or, you know, a friend or people who mean something to you, you're in a club. And there's just that difference. I think you're right. One of the main things is an ease of bringing it up, because you don't feel like, oh, how are they going to react? You're like, oh, I know how you're going to react. You know, like, I know what it means in a way.
Yes.
You know, of course, everyone's different. So, of course, I've never really thought about that. But yeah, there must be a club for people with debilitating illnesses. Who are like, yeah, we can make jokes about it, and you know I'm coming from a different position.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly it. I'm not coming from the position of just making fun of it.
Yeah.
And I am coming from the position of being concerned. Though I have to say, I have always been, and again, I was thinking about it when I was working on the show, and also I'm doing a longer version of the show in most places because I'm doing a sort of Q&A, and I've been trying to think of questions people might ask and things I'd talk about. And I am a terrible carer. Because I locked down my own feelings about my own pain when my mum died, it sort of made me a bit... Simon, our son... You know, if you see him, ask him, and he'll say, "Christ, Dad's really insensitive." Because, I mean, the things I do, a friend once years ago was telling Julie and me about the breakup of a relationship, which meant a lot to him, and he was very serious. And I suddenly saw Julie fix me with a stare, and I realised that I was flicking peanuts in the air, trying to catch them in the mouth, because I'd really lost interest in what this...
Oh, my God!
And I'm not good at talking to... having conversation, as Julie will put it.
Yeah,
she says
yeah.
sometimes, we're going to have a conversation, Paul.
Right, yeah.
About things. And one day she got the kitchen timer out, and she said, "Now, I'm going to set it to 5 minutes. We're going to have proper conversation for at least 5 minutes, Paul."
Yeah.
It's not long to ask. It's not a big thing. Just 5 minutes.
Wow.
So she set it for 5 minutes, and we started the conversation. And then I said, "Is that a fox in the background?" And she looked round, and I adjusted the timer to 2 minutes. Now that is just terrible, isn't it?
I mean, it comes from a place of just not wanting to get serious. Well, to get serious. And do you think that comes because your mum was sick and everything was so serious?
Yes.
That you just don't want to be
sometimes
back there.
I don't want to be there.
Yeah.
And strangely, and I'm, I don't, my, the comedy about Parkinson's, and I'm, if I think of jokes and everything, you would think that that would mean that you're wallowing in it.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about it a lot. But in fact, it's the opposite. It's as though it's happening to someone else.
Oh,
and
yeah,
when I think of jokes about, you know, the things that happen with Parkinson's, and when people say inappropriate things, I could get very cross.
Mm.
You know, when somebody, there was a charity worker who said, "We want to involve you in lots of fundraising, Paul. We want to get the most out of you while we still can." Now, you see, find that deeply offensive, but actually it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Because she meant it in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
But it's just
in the best possible taste.
It just comes out, you know. That, yeah. And there was a neurologist who had a wonderful way of delivering information like a roller coaster ride, because he wanted to tell you how it was, but he didn't want to, you know, let you down too seriously. Julie asked him, "Does Parkinson's affect life expectancy?" And he said, "Now that's a very interesting question. I'm glad you asked me that." As though he was talking to a room of students rather than someone with it.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, "Yes, well, we used to think that it did affect life expectancy, but then about 6 years ago, we decided that it didn't. But now we think it does."
don't forget,
down the water slide.
Yeah. Epilogue's here, guys. Yes. You think it's fine? Well, what happened? Oh my God! But I think that's incredible. Where it comes from almost doesn't matter sometimes, because I definitely make jokes of things because my dad died, and you know, when I was 15.
15.
Yeah,
that is young. That is a
seriously.
It's young, yeah.
Bad age.
It's not great. Yeah, it's not great at all. But I sometimes, like you said, the sort of benefits of it are you can laugh about things. And I do think, even though my therapist is constantly saying to me, well, maybe we need to stay in the pain, because I'm the same. It's like, try to make a joke of it, make a joke of it.
Yes.
And I think sometimes you can go too far the other way of constantly yes. making jokes about it. But I will argue for the sort of the magic of having that ability.
Yeah.
Because it gets you through life. It gets you through those difficult times.
Yes.
And it's a really good when things are really bad, like to survive, to make jokes to survive. I think the problem is in the long term, you have to then remember, oh, maybe I can stop making jokes briefly and have a conversation.
Yes.
But you sort of get locked into that making jokes. But for that sort of crisis point, it's invaluable, isn't it?
It's absolutely crucial. And it's why, you know, if you talk to paramedics,
yeah.
people, you know, in jobs where they're dealing with life and death, the jokes they tell
yeah.
would be, you would think, my God, these sick, terrible
bastards.
People. But in fact, of course, they're the opposite. And I remember having a conversation with a Jewish woman who helped with our Parkinson's dance class. I go to dance for Parkinson's classes. And there was this wonderful Jewish woman who came, and we were talking about difficult subjects, and she said some of the jokes she tells with her friends about the appalling things that have happened to Jewish people is, she said, it would make you amazed, and she said, but it's our way of coping, and that's a similar way, I suppose, what Mel Brooks was doing in The Producers.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's how we use comedy. I've always said, you know, in terms of satire and comedy and things, when I was working on sort of more daring programs than The Vicar of Dibley things, but I always used to think, you know, there is no subject you cannot tackle.
Mm.
As long as you tackle it in the right direction, because there is a comic point that can be made about pretty well anything, as long as you're very sure that the comic point is being made for a purpose, that is to point to the truth or to point to the what's crucial about it.
And especially if it is, like you said, your story. I think that's the other thing. I feel when anyone's ever... not many people have, but if anyone's ever sort of said, well, this is in bad taste talking about it, I've said, you know, it's my dad. I will crack jokes about his death. Like, that's mine. And, you know, I won't crack jokes about other people's tragedy. That's their job. It's like you own your grief.
Mm.
Did you ever speak to your dad about what happened?
A bit, not a lot. I mean, I love my dad. He died, what was it, 17 years ago. He was a wonderful man, very, very set in his ways.
Mm.
There was a right way of doing things and a wrong way. For example, he said to me, I don't want to nag, Paul, which means I'm about to nag.
Yeah.
But I really do think you should wear a tie when you go to work. I said, well, if I'm doing a show and I'm in front of the audience, I put a suit on. But if I'm just in the editing suite, I don't. But no, I'm not talking about being at the BBC in London, Paul. You are a commuter on British Rail and you should wear a shirt and tie. Because in his day, you know, commuters on British Rail wore a bowler hat and
came.
And he had these very sort of, he didn't really talk that much about it, I suppose. It was, I never found much of an opportunity to talk about it at all with him, which perhaps I should have done. But then he was happily married to Julie's mum.
Yeah. So,
and it was difficult then, I suppose, to talk about my mum a lot because he'd got over it. He did say once to me, he was talking about his own mum, he wasn't religious, but his mother, my grandmother, was religious. And he said to me, my mum has been saying I should believe in God now, because although Muriel, your mum, died, Paul, God has brought
Mia's second wife.
Mm.
And he said, and I can't accept that. I just don't think that it's as simple as that.
Which is fair enough. That's, yeah, the
way. And I thought that was very, you know, very powerful way of putting it, really. He was hilarious in the way he had no sense of the impact of what he said on people. He would say things like, I was perfectly reasonable, I mean, about the neighbour's garden. I was completely reasonable, completely calm about it. I just said, your garden's a bloody disgrace, mate. You need to sort it out.
Because he perfectly just, reasonable.
Just had that glorious yeah. way of being.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So when did he, how long was it till he remarried?
Married my second mum, yeah, as yeah, it were. Yeah. It was, so we got married when I was 21, very young, because I'd, and maybe that's to do with my mum dying
as
well.
Yeah.
So I married in 75, Julie and I got married, and then they got married 2 years later.
And is that how they met? For you and Julie?
They basically, I would be going round to Julie's house for Sunday lunch, and I would, and Julie's mum would say, Does your dad want to come round for Sunday lunch? So he used to come round occasionally. And then he ran a shop. He owned a shop in Bexhill. And Julie and I remember we used to chat about, you know, which customers might be potential partners for.
Right, yeah.
Little knowing that he was in fact meeting Julie's mum at the Cash and Carry on his half day off. And then, they're both gone now. So I can tell you, you go out to the cinema, parents go out to the cinema, or to the theatre or something, or to the pub, and they say to the son or daughter, we're going out, do you want to come with us? And the son or daughter says, no, I've got some homework to do. And then as soon as they're gone, they get them. Boyfriend and girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said to my dad, we're going out this evening. Do you want to come with us? No, I've got some stock taking to do in the shop. And when we came back, we couldn't open the front door. It was bolted. And we sort of stood back. And there was Judy's mum hurriedly closing the bedroom curtains. And that's how we found out. It was just fantastic.
That's amazing. That's hilarious.
And so, you know.
Oh, my God.
I have to, you know, do comedy because I come from a complete sitcom family. I mean,
I was like, that is total sitcom behaviour. That is the thing you see in a sitcom. You think, well, that wouldn't happen. But, yeah.
No, and then Julie's mum changed, because I was an Archer, Julie was Mayhew. We put our names together. Mm. And then Julie's mum, before they got married, and she moved in with my dad,
she changed her name from Mayhew to Archer.
Okay.
So the registrar, when we, the four of us were there in his little office, and he said, just need to just clarify a couple of things here. Mr. Archer, you're marrying Mrs. Archer, and your best man is Mr. Mayhew Archer. And Mrs. Archer, you're marrying Mr. Archer, and you're being given away by Mrs. Mayhew Archer. And you all live at 28 Haslam Crescent.
There's a sitcom in that, isn't
and
there?
Not only that, we thought, you know, when the time comes for Simon to get married, what if his wife says, I want to keep my name?
Yeah, then you've got...
Triple-barreled, So he thought the best thing to do is to marry her girl whose name is already Archer. So that's what he's done.
It blew my mind when he said her. So I was really confused. He was like, no, she's Archer. I was like, what do you mean? I don't... What are you going to call? What's your surname going to be? He's like, no, it'll just be Archer.
I mean, they don't know. I mean, she is my long lost daughter.
Oh, I see.
They don't know that. I mean, you know, they'll find out when the children come along and they count the fingers. It'll all come out in the wash eventually.
And maybe, you know, by then you can say it's not my problem anymore.
It's not my problem. No, I'll be so far gone with the Parkinson's, it won't be my problem anymore.
Oh my God. Are you writing all of this down? Like, are you sort of like this? Because that's such a beautiful image of you, how you found out about your dad.
I am. I'm going to be using it in my show,
and
I am writing it down because and I'm sort of and I'm using. I mean, little bits, little incidents in the film I've been.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah,
writing about my experience and there's parts of me in it. And actually, when you say, you know, talking about comedy and seriousness, that the problem I've had with the film I've been writing and the thing that, you know, my producer Hillary has been on about and Simon, son, has been on about, is trying to be, you know, serious.
Yeah.
Because I always head for the joke.
Head for the joke.
And sometimes you have to head away from the joke and show the real situation, as it were. So that's what I'm trying to educate myself to do.
I think if you're someone who always heads for the joke, I always say, like, that's not going to go anywhere. You can definitely do that. So if it gets too serious, you don't need to worry. Because you can then add the joke.
Yes.
But it's about, I think especially now, there is a fashion, and I think it's a good fashion. It's not, fashion makes it sound frivolous, but comedy is moving to this world where you can actually be very serious and very funny in the same show, which didn't used to happen.
No.
And, you know, the topics that are covered now, you know, even, I mean, this country, I think, really sometimes goes to places and shows like Catastrophe and, you know, they're tackling, and Derry Girls I just got into as well. They're tackling stuff that I agree with you, like, in the past, was not discussed. You just had a comedy. You would have had a comedy about four Irish girls. You wouldn't have mentioned what else was going on. And I think now it's, like you said, that world where your dad wouldn't even tell your mum that she was sick is so far, isn't it, from where we're at now, culturally, of talking about these things, or being able to make jokes about cancer and mortality.
And it's absolutely vital that we do it. And the one thing we've got to get... I mean, I think we're getting better with the illness. I think we're definitely, you know, we're normalizing it. We're not ghettoizing people who are ill and not talking to them. But the one that we still need to work on is death. And bereavement and grieving and how it, you know, and talking about the end. Because, you know, I can't remember who said it, was death and taxes are the only two certain.
Oh, it's American, isn't it?
I mean, I think with Trump and various people, it's really death, isn't it? Because they've worked out how to avoid the
other. Yeah, that's very true.
But it's sort of, I think that we still haven't come to terms with how to talk about death. And I don't know whether that's something particularly British. Is it?
I think we definitely, unlike most things in the world, we're doing very well at that. I would say. I think other countries perhaps we do very well at being difficult at talking about it.
Yes.
And certainly from doing this show, the only, you know, I haven't spoken to enough nationalities. But yeah, I think it's something we are successful at not talking about. But
not then, successful yeah. at not talking about.
But then you say, it's funny though, isn't it? Because we are, it is difficult for people. But then when you remember what it used to be like, that yes. illness was not even mentioned at all.
Mm.
I feel like, you know, I can't imagine that because I grew up where my dad was diagnosed, we all knew and it was discussed. And I know some, you know, even today, some people don't have that, but I think majority of people are, it's discussed at least. And I think, God, you forget how far we've come, even though, but it doesn't mean we can stop. Like, yes. there's still yes. a long way to go.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about, I hate to ask you this, but your own mortality, do you feel... Because of what maybe what happened to you and it wasn't discussed, are you trying to, with your family and friends, you know, you've made the jokey round robin, but are you yeah. trying to have those conversations or is it...
I am my own mortality. I did another podcast about the science of laughter and all of that, and it was with a chap called Mark Thornton, who's very good, and at the end, because of all the, you know, the things that had happened to me since I got Parkinson's, like discovering I love doing stand-up and yeah. comedy and performing and loving some of the exciting... You know, I did a podcast sitting next to the Archbishop of Canterbury. You know, fantastic. And although he did say that he preferred Father Ted to the Vicar of Diddley, I chose to forgive him. But it's those things... And he ended the thing by saying, are you glad you've got Parkinson's?
Wow.
And I said, well, you know, I know there will come a time when I'm not at all, and at times I'm not now, as it were. But strangely, and I upset my wife when I said it, and I can see why, but I said, you know, I was, because of the things that it had given me. But I am also aware of the that it will get worse. And we have sort of talked about, you know, ending it. And I sort of think about ending it and taking myself up. Julie said to me, she said, and I put, this is in the show, she said, you mustn't worry, Paul, if it gets too grim, I will take us to that place in Sweden. And I said, I think you mean Switzerland. And she said, oh, yes, yes. But I have a feeling she's going to take us to IKEA. And I'm not quite sure that's the answer. But I suppose I have thought about that. I've thought about the end. I don't know how bad it will be. I watched the documentary about Parkinson's, a miracle cure, And last week, incredibly moving, incredibly brave people. And I've got to know some of them. And some of the things that they were experiencing, you know, I don't particularly want to
yeah.
be experiencing that. And I suppose I'm using comedy and the effort it takes and the sort of the energy and the exercise that it gives me, as
yeah.
it were, to counteract it and keep the bad times further away
yeah.
in the hope that they may get to this cure before. I have no idea. It'll probably be too late for me. It is something I think about.
I think it's really interesting because we've talked about this a lot on the show when I was when Robert Webb came on and he was saying, you know, when you admit that a traumatic experience fundamentally changes you and when you admit that there's positives to that, it's then you sort of then loop back in to go, oh, well, then am I glad that my dad died? And it's not that. It's not. But it's just I think it's really sort of honest to admit there's always good and bad to everything.
Yes.
Like even, you know, brilliant things have sides that are like, oh, that's a bit annoying.
Yeah.
And when my dad died, you know, obviously it was, like you said, the most profound thing that ever happened to me. Mm. It's influenced everything. Clearly, here I am sort of talking about it. But I have tried to take positives from that, that it has made me appreciate things, it has made me more empathetic, it has made me understand the realities of the world. But that doesn't mean if someone, you know, gave you a button, you'd be like, oh yeah, sure, kill him earlier, I'll learn more. Like, you know what I mean? You don't feel like that. But you do have to admit that, like you said, it's not like if somebody said, oh, here's all the choices, do you want these things?
Yes.
You would be like, oh, yes, I'll take Parkinson's, thank you very much. Like, yeah. It's not, but it's...
Well, there were sort of choices. Strangely, I mean, I could have... I was 58, so I could have said, God, this is appalling. I was just slowing down, ready to enjoy my retirement and settle down and go on lots of holidays. And bloody Parkinson's, it's not fair. On the other hand, it has actually opened up opportunities for me that simply wouldn't have been there had I not had Parkinson's. So, and also, between getting an inkling that I'd got something wrong with me and discovering that I got Parkinson's, a friend of mine had a similar trouble with his arm not swinging or problems with his arm, and it turned out he had a brain tumour and he was dead a few months later.
Wow.
So given the choice...
You picked right.
I picked the right one, I think, you know. And my one of my best friends, you know, Jeffrey Perkins, you know, his 50s, you know, literally keeled down one day, keeled over, and that was him gone. And it was, you know, so I'd rather I had a long and lingering than just to go like that.
Yeah, I think, like, and I was on a panel at the weekend with talking about death, and there was a lady from the Copperfield charity, which is a breast cancer charity, called Chris, and she got terminal 4 breast cancer when she was very young, so in her early 20s. 10 years on, she's still here, you know, as the way the world, these things happen, and she was talking, you know, that she's very much accepted her death, she knows it's coming, and she said something which just really got me, because she said, you know, she's come to terms with her death. She's written a funeral plan, you know, or a not funeral plan. She doesn't want one. And she's talked to people. She's sort of done a lot of stuff. And she said, just because I got the terminal illness doesn't mean I'm going first. And I thought, God, that's so true, that it's very easy to look at the debilitating illness club and be like, oh dear, I hope that, and not realise that we're all in that club. That club is humanity. We're all going to die.
Yes.
It, you know, you maybe have more knowledge of what it might be that will maybe take you when you have an illness. But it's not like I can sit over here and be like, well, I'm okay.
Yes.
I'm going to live forever. It's not.
And we do have an odd attitude, because I do meet some people with Parkinson's, and, you know, and they say, oh, it's got really bad recently, and I don't know how much longer I've got, really. And I say, oh, I'm so sorry. How old are you? I'm 88. And you think, you've had a pretty good go, it seems to me. You know, I'm 66.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's sort of, you know, let's get these things in
perspective. Do you say that, Paul? Do you crack that open when they say that?
I don't. And I possibly should.
I don't know. Maybe that's the Archbishop of Canterbury's job, is to say.
Maybe it is.
You've done enough.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much for coming to talk to me. It was a complete and utter
really
delight.
I've really enjoyed it enormously.
Good. I'm very, very glad. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can follow Paul on Twitter at Mayhew Archer. His show Incurable Optimist is playing at the Soho Theatre in London this week, but then it's touring. Do head to his website, mayhew-archer.com, for more information on where he's going, and definitely go and see it. As you have learnt from this conversation, he is a brilliant, wonderful human being. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at TheGriefCast, and you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And remember, you are not alone.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.